Masters in Business is brought to you by the American Arbitration Association. Business disputes are inevitable. Resolve faster with the American Arbitration Association, the global leader in alternative dispute resolution for over 90 years. Learn more at ADR.org.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
Hey, welcome to Masters in Business. We have a special extra podcast this week. I went to one of the MTA, the Market Technicians Association's conferences earlier this spring, where I got to sit down with a legend of technical analysis. Alan Shaw is really everybody's favorite technician. There are so many people whose entire careers trace back to Alan Shaw. He was the founder of the MTA. He was somebody who just helped get so many balls rolling in the world of training and in the world of technical analysis. Many, many people owe a debt of gratitude for their expertise and their careers to him. A super nice guy. I think he's 84 or 82. Sharp as a tack, very witty. This was in a conference event. It was the two of us sitting in front of a few hundred people, so it's not the usual format. When you get a guy like that and he wants to just tell a story, tell an anecdote, and meander, hey, it's not up to me to interrupt him and keep him on a broadcast schedule. All I did was just kind of poke and provide and trying to keep him going. And it was really only about 45 minutes or so of conversation. If you are at all interested in technical analysis or market history, or if you just like the thoughts of the guy who called the greatest bond market rally in history dead on, a very outlier contrarian call, and who continued to get it right. It wasn't just one lucky call. He was pretty dead on and stayed dead on for a long time. Then I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. So our special extra holiday weekend podcast, my MTA event conversation with Alan Shaw. Let me start with a really interesting question. I've spoken to a number of technicians, and many of them have noted that they began on the fundamental side before switching to technicals. Tell us about how that transition, that evolution took place with yourself.
Well, I'm going to make a very long story, as short as I can.
We got 4 hours.
First of all, it's a real pleasure to be here with you all, and I thank you for showing your interest in all this. First thing I had to do was flunk out of college. My father, when he read the note that I was no longer wanted back, this was a school in central Pennsylvania called Susquehanna University. He said, son, he said, you'll never know what success is unless you fail every now and again. And I'll never forget that. And he came home from work the next day with a help wanted ad from the Wall Street Journal. And I answered the ad, went into the city to the Wall Street Journal's headquarters here, and they hired me as a glorified salesman. The Wall Street Journal was then expanding its business from being, you know, just a Wall Street type paper to being a daily, and reporting on the real news and this and that. And I would go around to brokerage firms and ask to speak to the manager of the office or whatever and try to sell subscriptions. And one day I found myself in Washington, D.C. The Wall Street Journal had just opened their brand new plant there on 14th Street. And I walked into an office of a brokerage firm called Harris Upham. And I got to speak to the manager, Edwin Bastable, his name was. And he said, young man, you're a pretty damn good salesman. We can use people like you in our business. I'm going to give you my card and make get you an appointment up at our main office in 120 Broadway in New York, and I'd like you to follow through. So, lo and behold, I went to 120 Broadway a few blocks away from here one day in 1958 and asked to see the fellow who was in charge of trainees. And I was escorted in to see a gentleman by the name of Henry U. Harris, Jr., who was the son of the senior partner. Henry was a partner himself. wonderful guy, and he said, well, you don't have a college degree. Don't hold that against you. I said, oh, don't worry about it, Henry. I'm going to school at night now. And I was going out to Adelphi trying to get caught up. That's a hell of a task to do, night school. And he said, well, let me check. And I got home that day, and there was a call waiting for me from Henry that there was an opening in the research department. And I said, I'll take it. And I did. I went to work. They showed me this little desk. The desks were about this wide, and there was one column of drawers on the right-hand side. And I was really in a clerical role, helping out some of the senior people there. But I was introduced to a gentleman named Ralph Rotnam, who was at that time the president of the New York Society security analyst. Right? Ralph was my mentor. I mean, he was the greatest walking, living historian. He could tell you what happened to the market after the battleship Maine was sunk on a moment's notice. Incredible guy. Harris Upham was set up in a way that, I have to tell you about my first paycheck. This is a real joke. I mean, I saw people getting these yellow pieces of paper every 2 weeks, and I wasn't getting one yet. And lo and behold, they got me the accounting department, and I got one of those yellow pieces of paper, and I figured it out. My salary was $58 a week. That's my starting salary. I still have that check.
Pre-tax.
That's funny. Pre-tax, yeah. funny. So Harris Upham had a research department that was like all others, mainly with people specializing in the steel industry, aluminum industry, you know, specialized analysts. But there was one slot missing. They didn't have a consumer non-durable analyst, like foods, tobacco, soft drinks. And I was Ralph Rotten's assistant now, to see. I was doing his relative strength work. This was my first computer. Still have it to this day. It's an old wooden slide rule. The only thing missing is the little slide that goes on it. That fell off many years ago somewhere. I asked Ralph, I said, you know, can I have a hand at this? I said, I majored in accounting, even though I didn't go back for my second year, but I love the course, and I know what FIFO and LIFO mean. Could you give me a... Could I possibly have a chance of following the food industry? And he said, well, okay. You sure about that? And I said, yes, I'm sure about it. And so he let me off on my own. I did research upon research upon research upon research. And the end result was the publishing of my very first research report in September 1960 under the Harris Upham heading at the top, Investment Opportunities of the Food Industry. And we tried our best to put forth why these stocks should be looked upon as growth stocks and not widow and orphan income stocks. Because there was an item coming into the industry called convenience foods. As a matter of fact, I had a whole paragraph about a guy named Clarence Birdseye. There was actually a guy named Birdseye, you know, and who invented the frozen food. And the profit margins on these products were exorbitant. It was amazing. And most of it is all going down to the bottom line. And I highlighted all of that in this report, and just scads and scads of companies recommended, because there were so many of them, from General Foods to Hershey Chocolate to Bury Biscuit. I mean, names that are no longer around, some of them. Now, little did I know at the time that my report was being published during a stock market cycle which was heavily favoring consumer non-durable stocks. Within the next year, every stock in this report, if it didn't double, it tripled. I was an instant hero of the research department. This was so funny. I mean, really, I still was only making $70 a week, but nevertheless. Ralph Rotnam commuted with a fellow by the name of Jim Morgan from Princeton every day. Jim Morgan was the head of a firm called Morgan, Rogers, and Roberts, which was headquartered at 140 Broadway. Morgan, Rogers, and Roberts in those days were the purveyors of point-and-figure data, point-and-figure numbers to make point-and-figure charts, and they had a chap on their staff by the name of Alexander H. Whelan, who had just published a booklet called Study Helps in Point-and-Figure Technique. Ralph had received a copy from Jim Morgan this one morning on the train, and I'm bringing him in his daily data. You know, he did overboard, oversold. I was always giving him his numbers, trying to do all this work, too. And he said, Alan, I got this morning. You might find it interesting. I said, oh, my God, Ralph, you mean well, this tit-tat-toe stuff, you know, he said, well, read it and see what you think. Well, I found this book fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So fascinating that I traveled over to 140 Broadway, which obviously was next door to 120 Broadway, where I was, and I introduced myself to Jim Morgan. I told him I wasn't making much money at this point, but was it possible that he could give me some copies of point and figure charts like General Foods, Stokely Van Camp, National Dairy Products, all the names of those days. He said, I'd be happy to. And I said, well, could you also supply me with the price change service that I need to keep these charts up to date every day? And he said, well, I'll have to talk to your boss about that because that does cost money. Well, I didn't want Ralph to know that I was keeping these charts, you know. This is the voodoo stuff, supposedly. So there I started in plodding away, making one-point reversal charts of all the stocks that were in my report. And finally, in the last half of 1961, a year or so after the publication of the report, I started to see patterns emerge in these stocks on the charts. Now, in Alexander Whelan's book, on page 12, he had a page of pattern identification. And he had a column called tops and a column called bottoms. And I started to look at my patterns. I said, my God, this is making a top. And I said to myself, how can this be? Well, my earnings estimates are coming through. Stocks are doing, you know, the stocks are all up. Of course, there was that key right there. You can't go down unless you're going up. I walked into Ralph's office. And I said, Ralph, I have admission. I pulled out the charts from behind my back. I've been keeping these in my desk drawer. That's why my knuckles been sore. Look at these patterns, this book, you see? The stock is topping out. He said, well, Alan, he said, maybe you're about to learn something which I hope you'll never forget. You're going to learn how to separate a company from its stock. Well, I was so taken back. What? What are you talking about, Ralph? Are you telling me that the stock might go up? And even though the company's earnings don't, you know, separate the company from its stock. And then the key phrase came out, barometer, not a thermometer. Never forgot all these things. Markets are discounting function. All the stuff I learned from him. So I said, well, do you have an objection if I put out a lighten up all wires to the branch offices since there are so many much profits in here? See, that was our terminology, not sell, right? Lighten up. So I sent out what we called in those days an all-wire message to all the 52 branches plus Geneva of Harris Upham with, of course, this was the basis of it, original report. These stocks have all gone up. They're starting to look a little suspicious on the tape. We have no objection if your clients want to lighten up. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this was in late 1961. And 1962, we had this incredible bear market, as you all remember, which finished with the selling climax of the Kennedy confronting the steel industry for raising prices in May of that year. My stocks collapsed. Every one of them collapsed. Now, how did I know that 45 times earnings was expensive for General Foods? It had never sold there before. You see, I had no historical evidence to go back and say, well, see what happened in 1930 or whatever, you know. So I didn't know until afterwards. And you know what, of course, 62 was called? A P.E. adjustment. Can you imagine going to a client, a broker, you've just been wiped out, Barry? It's just a P.E. adjustment. Don't worry about it. It'll come back. So at that point was the key for me.
Let me ask you a question about clients. I heard a rumor. I'm going to read this to make sure I don't get it wrong. Back in the 60s and 70s, you would do technical analysis knowing that clients might not be enamored of it, and so you would have to go out after you made your technical decision and find fundamental reasons to put, like, ornaments on a Christmas tree in order to sell the call to the client. True or false?
Well, that's not entirely true.
Is it partly true?
No.
Is it a little bit true?
It's a little bit true in this way. I began to run for the private client side a master list. This started at Harris Upham. We would recommend stocks based mostly on their technical credentials. And I would indeed at least get a yellow sheet in front of me to make sure it had earnings. And you know, wasn't going into the tube fundamentally, and I could get that from the little, you know, brief paragraph that was on top of the S&P yellow sheet. So I'd feel better about it. So there's truth from that point of view, and because we'd follow up the recommendation till the day we got out of it, and we would keep a track. We actually had a long, in fact, the publication that went out with a record of the transactions was longer than the actual recommendations themselves in size. So yes, at that point, we would do that just to check out.
So Ralph famously said, fundamentals tell you what to buy, technicals tell you when.
Very, very well done. Very well done. Yep.
Okay, so I'm going to move on from that. You said something earlier I want to revisit. How could these stocks be making tops when the fundamental news is right online and earnings are coming in for all these companies? It doesn't make any sense.
Well,
so how did you make the transition from that to, oh, the market's a future discounting mechanism?
Well, I remember the story about the stockholder who raised his hand at the annual meeting, and he asked the president, he said, Sarah, how's the business? And the president said to him, it couldn't be better. So the guy ran to the phone and called his broker and sold all his stock, and the broker said, what do you have? And he said, the president just told me the business couldn't be better. So, you see, that's the same thing, you see. You really tie it together, it's the same thing. I mean, stocks can top out when the business couldn't be better. Like they will bottom it out when the business couldn't be worse. Fear, greed. Greed, fear. You know, all that stuff. It all plays into that psychology, which is what about what we study. Now we call it behavioral finance. I love it. It's all part of reading a chart to a great degree.
So let me give you another quote from Tom Dorsey. The core advantage is that point and figure chart is strictly tied to the irrefutable law of supply and demand. It takes volatility totally out of the equation, unquote. How does someone know when to use point and figure charts versus traditional charts?
That's very good, Barry, only because of my experience. I would tell you, as I did in the other interviews, if you want to be a point and figure advocate, start with the one-point reversal. Learn how to make the one-point reversal. That's like looking at a short-term to intermediate-term trend as it unfolds. If the $20 stock becomes a $50 or $60 stock, you're now being invited to condense it into a three-point reversal. You see, point and figure is so versatile. If you start with the one-point reversal and then make a three-point reversal, a pattern that was this wide, perhaps, can become this wide for the same time period. And then point and figure also allows you to condense the vertical. Let's say you get a really high-priced stock. Make it a 10-unit chart or a 5-unit chart. It's got to go up and down 5 points before you put in that X. And you can see you can reduce your horizontal and your vertical, which we would do particularly in the high-flying days in the 60s, the Nifty 50 with Avon and all those kinds of names. Let me share some of these stories with you. You'll get a kick out of it. We built a very strong relationship with the Morgan Guarantee Trust Trust Department. They like every other institution in the city, were loaded to the gazelle with Avon products. I'll never forget the day I walked from 1345 6th Avenue, which was one of our offices there, over to their office on 57th Street with a Avon Products chart in my back pocket. And I walked into the head of the investment manager, and I covered up the name of the stock. I said, look at this stock. Would you be a buyer here or a seller here? And of course, I ask you if you're going to be a seller, that assumes that you own it. You can't sell something you don't own, but just give me an answer, one or the other. Would you be a buyer or a seller? He said, I don't think I'd be a buyer, not in a stock that's had a run like this. So I said, how about a seller? He said, well, there's not enough evidence of that. And I said, well, look carefully at how all these rallies, I had the one-point chart, see, how all these rallies are failing to get higher. A rally that fails to break out is selling into strength. Like a decline that fails to break down is buying into weakness. That's where the point and figure shines through and giving you the feeling of supply and demand, distribution versus accumulation. And so he looked at this, and I said, you know what? I said, entertain me and sell half of your million shares and see what happens. And he did. And that was the end of Avon Products. We just couldn't see it going up anymore. It wasn't that we could possibly see major risk yet, but it just didn't show any reward potential. So that's a great story. I used to do this a lot. I mean, I'll tell you the time I went to a major mutual fund in Boston. I won't mention the name. And I didn't see many people here. It's not yours, David. All the managers were sitting around the table, and I would go in with charts without names on them. And one time I sat there, and I had the guts to put these charts up on the wall. They were in the technology field in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, whatever. And I'd say, just simply, would you own these stocks? No hand went up. And as Louise would put it, they were forming frowns. She liked to buy smiles. These were forming frowns. And one guy got so pissed, upset at me, he came up and he took me to the door and led me to the elevator. And he said, get out of here. I never want to see you again. And the salesman sat there bewildered. What am I going to do? My analyst is being thrown out of here. And the salesman came to me. I said, Dave, we're going to be right. We're going to be right. Look at this. They threw me out. They're overweighted in these stocks. And there's no way. They're not going up anymore. And we were right. I'll never forget that meeting.
So you mentioned earlier behavioral psychology finance, yes. And behavioral finance. What does this say about a portfolio manager's ability to be objective? If he doesn't want to sell a stock, but if he's looking at a chart without the name on it, he has a very different read of it.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes you can be overinformed, right? Maybe just the reality of the chart picture. If you've got the understanding and you gain the feel, and let's face it, you all know this, experienced people, you feel the supply and demand when you keep your charts or your studies, whether it's by the computer or by hand. And I had a staff that kept up our 300, 400, whatever it was, point and figure charts every day, but I would slip in and take two or three books myself as many mornings as I could. Because the thing I love to do is actually see what is really going on and update these charts. Letting someone else do it wasn't really benefiting me at all.
Do you think technology has had a negative impact that you lose something when you're no longer doing it by hand?
Barry, there's probably a lot to be said for that. I mean, you know, I'm a peculiar person in the sense that I came in with a Dow at 400. 500, 1958, and left when it was well over 10,000. I lived through the greatest and participated in the greatest bull market in history, if you think about it. So a lot of my leanings are not going to be akin to now we're in an entirely different cycle, obviously. I personally think you're in another major bull move now that hasn't shown any signs of correcting. And we got into this conversation before. If you're studying the market today, throw out your linear charts. You need geometric charts. You need semi-log graphs. Last night, I was getting ready to go out to dinner with Ralph and the TV on. They had this woman, well, it could have been a guy, it doesn't matter, the person, was complaining that the market was down 40-some-odd points and it was crashing. How disappointing after being up 200 and down 40. And I said, my God, when it was 500, 40 points was crashing. But not when it's 20,000. That's amazing. There's no grasp of the reality, if you will, of where are we in the whole thing. That's why I love log charts. I mean, you just step back and take a look. Really fun.
Let's talk about the number, what you mentioned, 500. Let's talk about 100 and 1,000. You reference, and I'm assuming this is in the 66 to 82 period, the Dow tried to get over 1,000 repeatedly,
yes.
I think you said, 17 times.
Correct.
And failed. And you went back in the history books and you looked at 100,
yes.
And lo and behold, something similar.
Barry, thank you for bringing that up because, as I've said, that was my last piece of research that I published, and it was a joy to do. I love going back looking at the historic pictures, and that's exactly, thank God I had the books, all the stuff there in the room. But the study fell apart. I retired in 2004. The study fell apart really in the bear market at 2007-08, more so in the recovery, because we're not supposed to be through 10,000 yet in a material way. But the final sentence did say that the next major secular uptrend won't become really visible in 2018.
Will become visible.
In 2018. That part's on track. But what happened in the jiggles in between didn't seem to work out correctly.
So there's no significance about base 10 numbers, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000?
Well,
10,
it was all psychological anyway, mm-hmm. You know. But it was a fun exercise to do.
Okay.
It gave me something to talk about.
So everything you use, all of your indicators, all your strategies, all of that is publicly available to anybody who wants
That's
to...
That's absolutely right.
Right? Anybody who wants to do the work. What made your approach to technical analysis stand out?
I'll show you.
And how much of it was art and how much of it was science?
Very, very good. Please put the first page up first. I normally do this myself, but I'm not a member of the union. They won't let me do it. No, the first page. The very first page. The title.
The very first page.
The title.
The cover.
No, not that. This one. A technical bull case for bonds. Written in what year? May?
1985.
Based on our technical analysis, we believe that a structural bull market is underway for bonds. We believe the short, intermediate, and long-term indicators are allowing the best bond bet to be made in possibly the entire investment career of the reader. Where's the hedge there? Okay? Tell me that there's, oh, we're always hedging. We strongly suggest that balanced institutional and private investor portfolios contain a larger than heretofore prudent bond position. We believe that representation is blah, blah, blah. This trend is being published merely as a thought-provoking document that even the world's smartest man couldn't project with empirical climate. Oh, there's no references we make. Technical analysis helps uncover trends that lead the curious mind to explore the explanation. That's the spirit of the report. Now, in order to get our point across, I'm going to show you the best proprietary indicator. Let's flip a few pages till you get to the rubber band. Find a picture of there it is. Alan's hands under the Xerox machine. I had so much fun with this. I would go out, I'll never forget in Winston-Salem, a crowd of people like this, you know, private clients, or a big group, and I'd have rubber bands, a whole pocket full of them. And I'd start to stretch it, and the guy in the first row, of course, would be moving back, not knowing what was going to happen. All I was trying to point out here, you see, this is interest rates. This is the bond price. I'm very sorry. These are not rates. No, they are rates.
One, two, inverse.
Of course they are. I said, look, if rates could go from 8% to 14% in 4 years, why couldn't they snap back just as quick? That was the purpose of the rubber band thesis. And you know that's exactly what happened? Was that a forecast? No, it was something, get the mind open. It might happen. You know, it could happen. And what else do you all see? Come on, all you folks, look at this chart. It's wonderful. You see for the first time in the 40-some-odd years of interest rates, the first higher bottom. That was the clue to us. It was really the top and the price that caught our attention because we did not catch the high in rates, but we certainly caught the reversal and stayed with it for some years. And right now, we believe that rates are reversing again in a different direction. And as we used to say back in these days, interest rates are like a short sale. This, I get a kick out of the discussion, not here today, somewhere else maybe, about the interest rates. Remember, they can't go lower than zero. Oh, yes, they did. I know. We're negative rates. Yes. But you're not talking about something where it's 14% and it's got, you know, 140,000 basis points to go before it might hit zero. And this was not overly difficult for an open mind to accept that there was something happening. But the rubber band just kind of added a little fun to the whole thing.
So are you seeing the bond bull market that began in the 80s? Are you ready to say it's over? Or are you looking that it's coming to an end?
I'd say that the decline in interest rates would be over, so therefore the bull market in bonds would be over. Yes, I guess that's the guess. That's the position that we take.
So the
with the evidence that's unfolding.
If you're having a business dispute, the process can be slow and drawn out, especially if you rely on litigation in the courts. You can wait for years before your case is resolved, and the longer your case proceeds, the more your case can cost. Not with the American Arbitration Association. Arbitration or mediation with the American Arbitration Association is faster. In fact, nearly 50% of our cases settle prior to hearings. ADR.org. Resolve faster.
So the bull market in bonds is over. Can we say a bear market in bonds has begun, or is it too soon to say that?
Oh, it's way too soon. Yep. And Luis, what was it that you pointed out? The tops were sharp and the bottoms were curved?
So you retired officially in 2004.
Correct.
And then the market peaks in 07. Over the next 18 months, we see a 57% drop in the S&P. Were you watching that thinking, man, I could be making a killing now if I was still working? What were you thinking when you were watching
that? Well, I'll tell you this, and this is, again, a little confessions of the soul. I'm not in the booth, but anyway. I was on bended knees with a lot of my colleagues to sell their Citigroup stock at $55, which is the price it was the day I retired. I'm just backing up a little bit to the dates that you've got. This stock to me was forming an incredible reversal. Did I see it going to two? Of course not. Which it did? Of course not. But I sold all my holdings, which were rather large, thanks to Sandy and his profit-sharing plans. And I wasn't there going down to two. I was out, but I saw some of my colleagues with even more time at the firm than me wiped out. It was a horrible feeling to see. Because they just, you know, the dividend, the excuse was the yield. You know, the dividend's as good as the next director's meeting. Come on. Anyway, that was so sorrowful to see. So what's your question?
So as a retiree watching a major negative trend unfold, were you looking at it, aside from the obvious, my former colleagues, hopefully they followed my advice and sold, but were you looking at it as there is a huge trade to be made here, or how did you see
No,
all those thoughts.
My last best call was on gold in the early 80s. And my favorite stock was Newmont Mining. And I used to push the heck out of it, particularly to our private client. And I got the investment policy committee to actually allocate part of the portfolio strategist to the metal itself and the stocks themselves. And that was a tremendous move gold had and Newmont had and some of the others. And I walked away from all that in 1984, just before I retired. And those were the last point and figure charts I still have at home that were my gold shares.
2004?
2004.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I frankly, in the ensuing 10 years, don't even turn on the Cartoon Network anymore. I mean, that's what I used to call CNBC. I did. I used to, the Cartoon Network, yeah, geez. Entertainment, go watch these characters, try to explain what's happening.
So prior to the financial crisis, hedge funds had been doing really well, capturing a lot of assets and doing well for clients.
Right.
For the past decade, hedge funds can't seem to get out of their own way.
Yes.
What do you attribute that to?
The door has to be opened bigger.
Meaning?
There's too many trades trying to get through the same door.
So they're all doing, they're all crowded trades?
I think so. I mean, and I don't know, frankly, if I was practicing today really like we used to, I have no idea, even if there are price change services available like our point and figure service was, to keep charts like that up to date. So, I mean, I'm so out of it. They're out of business. And I was talking briefly before to our president about how they took over the R.W. Mansfield Company and keeping that service alive, which is gratifying. That was one of my favorite. I'd had that delivered to the house on the weekends and spend 2 hours every Sunday pouring through the Mansfield charts. It was really that simple. I mean, you didn't have to have complicated allograms or whatever they're called. And y's over 2 squared and x, y, z's in a parentheses. God, I could never get through the financial analyst handbook. It was so difficult because I never took statistics, of course. That's one of the reasons. But I do know the difference between linear and log.
What about technology today? What is Incredible. The impact of massive computing power on charting?
Well, I don't know the answer. I honestly don't know the answer. All I can say is one of my first trips to Tokyo, where incidentally technical analysis really got its birth, as you all know, back a few centuries ago in Japan. I was taken to the Tokyo Stock Exchange and shown the room where computers were trading with computers. And all I could see were these lights flashing. There were no people, nobody, just the computers going back and forth, matching and selling and buying and selling. And I'm sure that there was some candlestick chop maker somewhere, trying to take this information and put it on with a pencil on a piece of paper that these computers were doing. I don't know the answer to the question, because see if you can just take this another step further. We're not running those computers. They're running themselves. Mm-hmm. We're not the brains behind whatever trades they're making. So are they displaying their own emotions? Do the computers have emotions? Do they overheat, an example? Or do they run out of power? Do they go through climaxes, selling climaxes, buying climaxes? I mean, I don't know, all that, to answer your question.
So now that you retired, you mentioned some media. When you're looking at the industry today, be it Wall Street or technicals or just trading in general, what makes you crazy? What do you look at and just do that with?
Oh, that's a good question, because it came up before too. The reporting I heard last night, I do that too. The fact that you're talking about a 20,000 level, and you're worried about 40 points. Because the average person on the street who's listening to you doesn't put it in that perspective. They hear the 40 points and they don't think of it on a 20,000 base. I have just one thing I still may have here in this incredible pile of stuff. Incidentally, Hank, I brought along something that you wrote, The 21st Century Technician by Hank Pruden. And that's an incredible piece of artwork on there that was chosen for this piece. You remember that, Hank, when you wrote that? And that was the future of technical analysis in the academic's eye of Golden State University. Looks pretty chaotic, doesn't it? That's about what you were talking to me about there. But once a month, this young lady up here puts out this piece of research. Look at this. Look at this. My God. I give her so much credit, because I wouldn't even be able to get past the first 10 pages, not 60. I'm proudly listed on here as a consultant emeritus. Or is it emeritus? Emeritus? I don't know. I always feel like I have a problem with my right arm.
It's a little emeritus.
It's so heavy, a little emeritus. But, to follow all that's going on, and get it to be concise and mean something, I think is really, really today the challenge of the technical analyst. But Ralph's right, Ralph. I would not, in my discussions with a client, I'd never talk about the shampoo, okay? I'd never mention the term head and shoulders top or bottom. I would call it a top, a distribution pattern, or an accumulation bottom, or a reversal pattern. I'd never give them the opportunity to come back and laugh at me. You're the guy with all those wedges, triangles, shampoo products, gaps, Delaware water gap, all that kind of stuff. You never have to bring that up. Just, bring up the reason that those patterns were forming as your excuse. Distribution. Accumulation, supply, demand. And I used to show the point and figure targets to some people, and I never believed them myself. But I had a report out on Boeing when the $20 stock. I had a $120 price target for Boeing. And I told the clients, I said, I don't believe it. But I'm showing it to you. The method is allowing me to you express this possibility. And I was wrong. It went to 150. God, what a bull market that was. I'll never forget it. That's so incredible time.
So I know we only have about 10 minutes, and there's a handful of questions I want to get to.
All right.
You mentioned some of your early mentors, the people who mentored you in the business.
Ralph Rotman.
Who were the investors that you that influenced you, that you were impressed with, that you followed in the early days?
Well, that's a good question. I went back and, of course, read all the major history books. I'm sure everybody has, about Jesse Livermore. And I went back and studied entirely the Harold Gottlieb series, which was published in the 1920s. And I was also a Schaubach of books. Incidentally, he was Tony Tabell's uncle, you know, point and figure work and stuff back in the 30s. And my idols on Wall Street, let's put it this way, instead of investors, Ken Ward at Hayden Stone, point and figure charts, Edmund W. Tabell at Walston with Son Tony, point and figure charts. I never knew what Bob Farrell practiced over at Merrill Lynch. Oh, I only saw his written work. I never knew what went into it. I don't know whether he kept point and figure charts, but the three real point and figure chart people were Harris Upham and Hayden Stone. And Ralph, do you know what happened to Ken Ward's charts? Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, he was a fascinating fellow. I got to know him not for too many years, unfortunately. I got to know him when he was in his late 70s and he expired in his 80s. And then Ed Tabell, Tony's father, and then they actually computerized their point and figure work. And Ken Tower, of course, who's here, was one of Tony's right-hand men and helped with all that process. Tony was our second president, incidentally.
Let me ask you a little bit of a trick question. You've told us about a couple of outstanding calls.
Right.
Tell us about a call that went wrong, a call that failed, and what you might have learned from that. I assume once, at least. Once, not once.
I had a call that failed that I could not learn from.
Really?
Yes.
You'll have to explain.
I will. I recommended selling short Teledyne. The stock was 110, and I was feeling fairly certain that the stock was in the process of a pretty big top, where at least, though, it could sell off to 80. I recommended it, sent out a wire, put it out there. Short sale, and that's kind of an interesting thing. I had to check with my back office. Do we have shares to loan? I mean, there's no sense doing something you can't do business in.
Right.
You know, if we couldn't find the shares for the guy who wanted to sell it short, don't bother with it. Well, 2 days after that recommendation went out, Mr. Singleton announced a buyback. Nothing I had a control over, but at 10 points higher than where I recommended the shorts. Now, I couldn't do anything about that. I was really wrong on that one. But it was out of my control. You know, he came out and announced a buyback. Now, did he know about this recommendation, do you think? You think he did? I don't know. I mean, this is little Harris Upham back then, you know? You know, somehow probably could have triggered it down to him. Things, the news travels fast. Oh, that, incidentally, I think I mentioned it before. You want to get more involved in what you're doing, go back and read all of Alvin Toffler's books. Start with Future Shock. Start with the understanding of the acceleration of the rate of change, because that's what the stock market's been doing for years now and probably will continue thanks to the technology. But do read those books. They're incredible. They'll start with The Wheel and Fire and all that, but marvelous book reading.
Let's talk more about books. The single most asked question I get about any guest I have is always, what are their favorite books? So Toffler's Future Shock.
Well, that was from a macro perspective. Mm-hmm. How Charts Can Help You in the Stock Market by William Giler. Very simple. Published back in the 60s.
Thin little volume.
Well, I guess it might be now. Technical Analysis of Stock Trends by Edwards and McGee. Way out of date. But nevertheless, if you want to see a Charter Studebaker packet, what it looked like back in those days, you know, it's in the book. Let's see. I read all the Granville books. I knew Joe, not personally, but enough that he had let me know if he was in town or something. He was a character. God bless him. He was a showman, let's face it. But he put on a damn good show. Now, let's see. Who else was in there? Well, all the books you're all familiar with, I'm sure I've read. Garfield Drew's books on odd lot theory. What's an odd lot? You ever hear about it anymore? Do they trade odd lots anymore? God, you see, there's an example of how we've moved along. Mm-hmm. That was followed every single day.
On the assumption that it was the small buyer.
Was always wrong.
Mm-hmm.
When the odd lot on buy on selling got high, you should be buying. When it got low, and of course, Bob Farrell had proprietary work with the size of Merrill Lynch's buy-sell trades every day. He was right on top of all of that stuff.
What indicators no longer have validity? What indicators have faded from usefulness? And what does an analyst do when they're starting to suspect one of their favorite tools no longer works?
Barry, that's a wonderful question. And I'm glad that both Louise and Ralph are here with me today, because in our chart room, we had a wall as long as that wall back there on one side of the room, which was all sliding corkboard, and had 10 square to the inch chart paper pasted together from top to bottom, which daily work was posted. So that side there would have been about 8 or 9 years of daily indicators, that size of the wall. And it was set in such a way that we wouldn't walk up to the wall to look at it. We would stand 20 feet back and stare and see what was going on. And one of the things that was driven home to me is never listen to people who tell you they're bearish on the market because it's overbought, or they're bullish on the market because it's oversold. You all know how those indicators are calculated. You all know the data that go into those indicators. So think about it. An overbought market is bullish. An oversold market is bearish. I mean, you don't buy because it's oversold. You wait until it comes out of the oversold condition. You wait until the oversold condition alleviates itself. And that's the market telling you the selling pressure, which is what caused it to get oversold, is easing. I mean, I'll never forget in 1987. The market went oversold on Thursday before Monday in October. It came out of the oversold in November. Now, when would have been the better time to buy, the Friday before the Monday crash, or in November when it was all over and it was starting to recover? And we could see that just by standing and looking at the wall. It was amazing. Yeah, those were the good old days.
So what other books besides
besides
the classic technical analysis books? Toffler is so off the beaten path.
Yeah, that's...
What other books along those lines stay with you that may not be pure TA, but have something to teach? And anything leap out?
Good, you got it. Yeah, the madness of crowds. Help me along.
Yes.
Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Is that it, right? By who? McKay, yes. That's a good one. Crowd Psychology. Do read Humphrey Neal's Reminiscence of a Stock Market Operator. He was the creator of Contrary Opinion. That kind of stuff is helpful, again. And everything that Bob Prechter writes, read carefully.
I have the
greatest respect for that young man. His behavioral finance that he's coming out with now and the work that he's doing. I mean, he's so on. And he's such a pleasant person, past president of the MTA, to talk with and listen to. And he's a member of Mensa, you know. He's extremely intelligent. Any work Bob does, pay attention to. And also Ned Davis. I'm a fan of Ned Davis, too. I remember when he started working for Wheat Securities in Tennessee. He used to have a little hayseed coming out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
What a powerful operation today.
Jeez. All right, so we're down to our last two questions.
Oh, boy.
If some youngster came to you and said, I'm thinking about going into research. I want to become a technical analyst, what sort of advice would you give them?
Punt.
Punt.
Oh, Barry, what a hard question.
I thought you were giving them the advice to punt. You want to punt on the question?
Yeah, I was listening to the talk yesterday, and I couldn't agree more with what Frank and everybody were saying about the difference between the buy and the sell sides. I mean, in my day, remember I said I went to do the technical work because nobody at Harris Upham was doing it. Mm-hmm. And there was technical work coming out of Hayden Stone, Walston, Merrill Lynch, R.W. Prespretz, Joseph Thal and Company, and Reynolds and Company. They're right above me, four above me. They all had somebody doing some sort of chart reading or a daily, you know, tip sheet or whatever you want to call it. You don't have that today. I mean, how many sell sides do you have left even? When I told you how I did my family tree one day, I sat down and doodled and I mean, Colin Loeb-Robe, Shearson Hamel, Harris Upham, Smith Barney. I mean, they're all, I came up with so many firms, EF, WE, Huttons, they're all within my firm. I mean, so look at all the firms that disappeared. Hutton used to have, of course, Phil Roth, Newton Zinder, a lot of, you know, they were all, those positions were there. So you had at least a way to answer that question, you know, and make a decision if you want to. You can always switch, I would say, if we're back in those days. Get a job on the sell side. You can always switch to the buy side, maybe. Mm-hmm. But and I think these guys hit it on the nose yesterday, too. I think Frank said it. I forget now about maybe more opportunity on the buy side than the sell side for this discipline.
And my last question, what is it that you know about technicals and investing and trading today that you wish you knew 45 years ago when you began?
I never took myself seriously. I took my work seriously. I was never afraid to make a fool out of myself. The rubber band thesis was a good example of that. I mean, somebody would have looked at that and said, what child play, maybe. But it told a story. You see, that was the main point to get that across. Open the mind. Technical analysis is a mindset. It lets you explore. Gives you the ability and the freedom to do so. And the other thing that's great about it is that you can set risk points, aka stop losses. You can do things that will help you understand that maybe you made the wrong call and not let the loss run. You want to let the profit run. Three major outcomes. They brought it up yesterday. Mm-hmm. Small losses, large losses, small profits, big profits. We're in for the big profits and the small losses if possible. I think I said this earlier, and I'll say it again. That I'm very humbled to be here again, but I'm so happy that I'm not practicing today, knowing what I went through and how, quote, easy it was compared to the challenge and chore today. I mean, that was my first computer. Then I went to a Monroe calculator where you had to pull the handle and the numbers would spin. And then I had an Apple, and then MS-DOS. And I went through all through that, learned Excel and Lotus and all that stuff. You know, today it's just so incredible what you've got at your fingertips, what you can do. But I also am a firm believer of the KISS syndrome. You all know that one. Keep it simple, stupid. Try not to get too overly involved, and especially if you're on the sell side, do avoid those shampoo ad terms and things like that when you talk to a client. You don't need to tell them it's a head and shoulder top. Just tell them it's a top. And you don't open yourself to the ridicule or criticism, that stuff, the wedges, the gaps, the pennants, the flags, et cetera, et cetera. It's all what it is.
Well, thank you, Alan. It's been my privilege to be able to sit up here and ask you these questions, and I'm sure everybody in the room appreciates your time and your wisdom.
Well, thank you so much.
Masters in Business is brought to you by the American Arbitration Association. Business disputes are inevitable. Resolve faster with the American Arbitration Association, the global leader in alternative dispute resolution for over 90 years. Learn more at ADR.org.